My name is Del Bigtree. I'm the host of the internet talk show, The High Wire. Thank you. I have a nonprofit called Informed Consent Action Network. I started out as a producer for the CBS talk show, The Doctors. I spent nearly a decade celebrating science and medicine on television. I won an Emmy Award in that process. But then I stumbled upon the issue of vaccines and safety around a whistleblower at the CDC. I made a documentary about Dr. William Thompson, who came forward and said they were committing scientific fraud on the vaccine safety studies. That changed my life forever, and I made a documentary called Vaxxed. For those of you that don't know, Dr. Robert Malone, sitting to my left right here. Dr. Malone is a scientist and physician, one of the inventors of the mRNA and DNA vaccines. Having worked with many of the world's largest vaccine makers and biotech companies during the COVID pandemic, he has been among the most articulate, outspoken, and scientifically sound voices in the medical and scientific community, earning enough trust to spur a Substack presence with more than 10,000 paying subscribers and millions of views thanks to his blockbuster appearance on the Joe Rogan Show. If you didn't see that, I think that was a game changer. There's a lot more here, but we'll move on. Dr. Robert Malone, a true hero for those of you in the audience that got the vaccine. We're going to have some discussions about what that thing really is. Over here to his left, Dr. Pierre Corey. Dr. Corey is a critical care physician who burst into the public debate about medical treatments during the pandemic by advocating for the widespread use of ivermectin and other drugs for COVID treatments. One of the founders of America's Frontline Doctors, Dr. Corey, has twice testified in front of the U.S. Senate to promote ivermectin and other alternative drugs in the treatment of COVID. And then finally, at the far end over here, Dr. Richard Urso. Dr. Urso is another member of America's Frontline Doctors, a highly regarded ophthalmologist who's worked at Houston Eye Association for nearly three decades. He was an early proponent for use of hydroxychloroquine as treatment for COVID, and in July 2020 met with Vice President Mike Pence and his chief of staff, Mark Short, to promote the prescriptive use of hydroxychloroquine. Just because, you know, we've all been through a really wild experience together, and history will, you know, slowly figure out what happened here and who was where. But as we sit here in the conference, it's all about truth and about transparency and getting back to having control of our own lives. I would just a sense of the audience for all of us. Did anyone in the audience use hydroxychloroquine during this pandemic? Okay, very interesting, right? So something that was sort of vilified by the media, but yet you went out and made that happen. How about ivermectin? Did anyone use ivermectin? Look at that. Pierre Corey, your job, well done. And then for those of you out there, how many got the COVID vaccine? Okay, all right. All right, great. So now we have a sense of who's in the audience. And look, this is the world we live in. The majority of, you know, of the first world nations all got this vaccine. So to start out with, what I think is interesting, Dr. Robert Malone, since you are credited with being an inventor of this COVID vaccine, actually not specifically COVID, but the mRNA technology, right? And I'll sort of say that, you know, I've interviewed you many times that, you know, originally it was going to be used as gene therapy. That's what you got involved in, right? Was inserting, you know, we've all been looking for some way to change health problems by inserting an mRNA or something that delivers a shift in
the idea DNA. Was to treat these poor children that have inborn errors of metabolism, birth defects, genetic birth defects. Is there some way that you can help a child that's born with a birth defect? That was the genesis of all this.
Okay.
And the idea of using mRNA was a way to avoid the toxicity of a classic gene therapy that would forever alter their genome.
Okay.
And the mRNA was an easy application for vaccines. It didn't work very well. But it turns out for making a vaccine response, you just need a little bit of protein. And so the original idea was that this little bit of protein would be made very briefly because the RNA would be degraded very rapidly. Now, that's all gone sideways with the current situation.
So just very quickly, the gene therapy wasn't working very well, as I understand it, because the immune system was attacking the mRNA as it was trying to deliver the coded message to try and help these kids in their, you know, and sort of redesign how their body was dividing cells and everything else. So you said, you know what, it doesn't work here. It would be great for a vaccine because it doesn't need to be around a long time. Doesn't, if the immune system's attacking, in some way it's good, right? Let's just touch the immune system for a second. It'll react, start creating antibodies, and therefore, and then get out of there, because if it stays around too long, you have autoimmune disease, right? You have other sorts of issues.
This is a classic make lemonade out of lemons.
Okay, and so that's what you did. That was the idea of let's use mRNA technology for a vaccine. And so just to sort of sum all this up to get us to where we're at with this vaccine, it seems to me, and you said this recently, and it really stuck with me, that the entire genius that you had around using mRNA as a vaccine is because it wouldn't linger. It wouldn't hang around. It'd be there for a moment. It would start an antibody production. Our bodies start ramping up an immune system, and then it gets out of the way. We've got immunity, and we're all moving on. But the one thing they did, at least the major change, when we now look at the vaccine, and you know, when we're looking at Pfizer and Moderna, and we're looking at these vaccines, they didn't just deliver the mRNA as it stood, or in this case of the spike protein, they made a change to that spike protein. Explain what they did that changed sort of what I think was the brilliance of a short-lived mRNA into a Frankenstein, as you will.
Well, that's kind that you use that term. And I want to give a shout out to a German company called CureVac, which is still true to my original idea. Now, what happened was that Moderna and BioNTech employed the technology developed at the University of Pennsylvania by Katie Kuriko, former Hungarian intelligence person, and Drew Weissman, former Tony Fauci postdoc,
okay,
which is the random insertion all the way through the RNA of a modified molecule called pseudouridine. And this is a molecule that is present in natural RNA at very specific points, highly controlled, which alters the immune response, the inflammatory response associated with the RNA, and it also controls how long the RNA stays around. And when they made their discoveries trying to address the problems that caused me to abandon the technology,
okay,
in the mid-90s, and later, really up to about 2000s when they did it, and they inserted pseudouridine all the way through the RNA. This is not a natural RNA. This is a new synthetic thing.
Right.
To call it mRNA is false. It has characteristics of RNA. It also has characteristics of more like a single-stranded DNA. And we now know this is stuff that should have been done before it was injected into all of us.
Right.
But a fantastic,
yourself included, right? You're talking about a product that you have.
I knew I had to travel, and I knew I had long COVID. And it was hypothesized that it would help with the long COVID. And absolutely, if I hadn't taken it, I couldn't have been able to serve the world in the way that I have by traveling to Europe, et cetera.
Right.
In any case, the logic was that if you put this pseudouridine all over in the RNA, it would make it less inflammatory and it would help it stay around longer. And they should have characterized that. Was that actually a good thing? Like with a lot of things, just because it may sound good in some ways, there's often an unintended consequence,
sure,
of blowback. Yeah. And they didn't do the non-clinical testing. That is now clearly documented to characterize where this goes, how long it sticks around, how much protein it makes. Fortunately, finally, a group at Stanford did this and published it in a journal called Cell, one of the top journals in the world in academic publishing. And they didn't just do it in a test tube or in mice. They did it in humans that had been injected in their shoulder, just like you or me that received the vaccine. And then they did what's called fine needle aspiration. They pulled cells out of their lymph nodes and they tested, is the RNA still there? And is it still making protein? And how much protein is being made in the blood? And they found some amazing things. They only tested for 60 days, so kind of 2 months.
Right.
And what they found was the RNA is still there at 60 days. It's still producing protein. And during that 60-day period, the amount of spike protein being produced is considerably higher than the amount that's produced when you're naturally infected by the natural route of your naso or oropharynx. And so what we have here is something that is very, very different from what was intended, from what was natural, And frankly, this is another case where the pharmaceutical industry lied to physicians again and again, telling them that this RNA just sticks around for a short period of time. They lied to your physicians, they lied to you, and the FDA covered it up and didn't make them do the studies that would have shown it. But now the data is out. The cat's out of the bag.
And so ultimately, this lingering in the body is leading to real concerns of cancers, of autoimmune disease and things, because it's in places it shouldn't be. It's settling in organs. And we're going to have trouble clearing this out of the body.
Every single component of this turns out to have problems.
Right.
The payload is the slang we use. That's the thing that's made. That's the spike protein. Some of you may recall, if you were awake at the time, when I was on the Brett Weinstein podcast, I said spike is a toxin. And that was another one of those third rail triggers that caused the press all over the world to say, oh, no, it's not a toxin. It's unequivocally clear now, many references, spike is a toxin. It has all kinds of toxicities. The cationic lipids have toxicities,
so, and we'll get to that,
and the RNAs have toxicities.
So to imagine that it's toxic, what you're saying is we basically have a payload that they're bragging about the fact that you're getting more of this toxin than you would have gotten from the natural virus, and it's a Frankenstein version that doesn't die inside of you, keeps going on and on. Dr. Urso, you've done, you're one of the guys up here that's actually designed drugs, you've brought a drug all the way to market, you've worked through that process. Tell me about the fatty lipid, because I think this is something really important. This is a part of a technology you've understood, the delivery system wrapped around this mRNA. What are your concerns about the fatty lipid? What did we know, and where were we not told the truth about that?
So the lipid nanoparticle, this is the first time in history that a vaccine goes everywhere. It's going to your brain, it's going to your bone marrow, it's going to your ovaries, your adrenals, it's going places that vaccines normally don't go. And the majority of it is not staying in the arm. And so that was one of the first times in history that we've had a product that's actually designed to go everywhere, and this is well known. It was not something, when we were working with chemotherapy at a major oncology hospital about 15, 20 years ago, we found we were trying to carry chemo to the brain. And we actually ended up wiping out the bone marrow and other tissues. And so we said lipid nanoparticles are too hard to control, so we kind of abandoned that approach. Because normally if the tumor is in the brain, you want to bring chemotherapy there. You have to do spinal tap to do it. You know, you can do radiation and other treatments. But it's very hard to get through the tight junctions and get medicine to the brain. And this is the first time in history we have a vaccine that's going to the brain. So the distribution's a big deal. As Dr. Malone just said, the payload is unpredictable. And for several reasons, the payload's unpredictable because one, the production is the first time in history we're making this big cake of fat and other things and mixing it all together. And so you're not even, you know, the first time that anyone's ever made this in large batches. This makes it very difficult to have a consistent product. Some of the batches are going to work better than others. But more importantly, you're also going to see that the production, the payload, we don't know. Normally, if we give you a vaccine, we know what we give you, and that's going to stay there. And then as you talked about, you have all the other things that are unique to this spike protein. But the main thing I really want everybody to know is a lipid nanoparticle messenger RNA platform is uncontrollable right now. It is a terrible technology for the vaccine industry to go down. And that's the thing that you need to get in your mind, because they're going to use this for RSV. They're going to use this for everything. And basically, they've made us sort of get used to that vernacular. Hey, this is safe and effective. That's safe and effective. It's not safe and effective. It's clearly not safe because the lipid nanoparticle has toxicity itself. This is well documented. The lipid nanoparticle causes inflammation that, for instance, can lead to things like MS and other things in the brain because of autoimmunity issues. So it's very inflammatory, and it's not safe right now.
I just want to sort of follow that up with, you know, when I started diving into this conversation about vaccines, which made me leave the Doctor's Television Show to make the documentary, the comment that's always made is there's no way the vaccine causes autism, which is one of these debates that's always been out there, especially for parents that have gone through this with their children. There's no way it would cause autism. That's a brain disorder. The vaccine does not cross the blood-brain barrier. It never gets to the brain. And that's always been the argument against, you know, any idea that vaccines cause the harms that many many people say they do. But in this instance, and you know, I'm not going to get into that conversation, but in this instance, they said the same thing. This vaccine is staying located in the arm. It's perfectly safe because of that. And what you're saying is in chemotherapy, they were using these, you know, lipid nanoparticles. The very task was to figure out how to deliver the drug to the brain, to get it past the blood-brain barrier so that you could get chemo there. And so when they took this product and wrapped it around a vaccination and told us all it's going to stay where it's located, you just used a delivery system that was designed to get to the brain. I mean, that's what's so phenomenal about the lie that took place here. Now, I want to take a step back, because while that's in laboratories, Donald Trump is promising us we're going to, you know, warp speed this out because it's our only way forward. Tony Fauci's out there. What one of the things that I've talked a lot about on the high wires, you had an emergency use authorization. The only way, if you were going to rush this process of getting the vaccine out to market, yeah, you can rush the process of developing something, throw a lot of money at it, but you can't rush a safety trial that should be 2 years. You can't see in 3 weeks what we would know 2 years down the road. And the only way you can legally do that was an emergency use authorization. At that point, the FDA has this emergency use authorization distinction. And in it, it says you can only use it. You can only rush a product out to people without proper safety testing if and only if there's no other available product to take care of the individual, to protect the individual. In this case, and it sort of started out with Donald Trump said, you know, I like hydroxychloroquine. I'm hearing a lot about this. And Tony Fauci pushes him out of the way, grabs the microphone, said, don't listen to him. It's dangerous. We know nothing about it. You know, went on this tirade. We all sat there going, you know, what's going on there? But hydroxychloroquine's out there, it gets attacked, it moves on its way. Along comes ivermectin, which is where you really, I think, come into this story. So they're trying to rush this vaccine. They're not gonna get the vaccine on the market if there's a drug that works. And then you step before the Senate and give one of the most impassioned testimonies I've ever seen. What had you seen in ivermectin, and what brings you into this story?
So, you know, I want to say, so as an ICU doctor, we had spent the early part of the pandemic really focusing on how to treat the critically ill. We hadn't focused too much on therapeutics and early treatment. My colleague here, Richard Urso, recognized very early on, like Fauci knew, hydroxychloroquine was effective. What I learned is something that Richard lived through, which is that in 2020, there was a global disinformation campaign attacking hydroxychloroquine. It's a generic repurposed drug, and the pharmaceutical industry has long had that as a business model. They cannot have generic drugs in the marketplace because it absolutely robs them of the profit potential for novel pharmaceutical products. And what they did to hydroxychloroquine was far more sinister than ivermectin, because they were able to design trials using toxic doses, which actually caused increases in deaths. They couldn't do that with ivermectin because the more you give, the better it is. So,
wow.
So that was the one non-sinister thing they did. But after I came out with that testimony was a result of months of me and my partners in the frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, where we studied therapeutics. We looked at every trial on anything, preprint server, published, and we started to see the signal build up around ivermectin. It was just so reproducible, large magnitude effects in reducing hospitalizations and deaths and time to clinical recovery, time to viral clearance. We hadn't seen anything like that. All the studies on a lot of stuff were uneven, a little bit conflicting. Hydroxychloroquine, the vast majority were positive, but you had to treat early. And I finished my paper and I submitted it to a journal, because I heard of a journal, a high impact journal, where somebody suggested a special issue on the use of repurposed drugs in COVID. And that person suggested that issue, and the editor to whom I met and submitted it to was the guy sitting next to me. Right? So, that's credit to Robert, you know, who has been involved in vaccine development and pandemic responses for most of his career. He knew to fight this disease, we needed to use what was available, and now. People were dying, the ICUs were filling. And as we tried to get that information out, and Richard and the America's frontline doctors tried to do it with hydroxychloroquine, I discovered that I launched myself into the middle of that war, and I became an enemy. And the world went sideways. I thought we were doing the right thing, putting forth knowledge of a drug that could help millions, And I started getting personally attacked. Paul Marrick, my colleague and mentor and the founder of our organization went under attack. And suddenly we saw censorship like we never could believe on all social media channels. We couldn't receive donations because PayPal cut us off. Our press release wires. I mean, if you're not being censored, you can't see it. And so I saw this amazing global apparatus of trying to censor us and neutralize us, and we're still fighting that war today. And then the later phase of that ivermectin war was when they started pulling the stuff they did with hydroxychloroquine, which is trials designed to fail or trials that were fraudulently designed and conducted, at massive frauds that were landing on the front pages of the highest impact medical journals in the world, which would then launch, you know, front page headlines. And I've had to watch this atrocity every day for now 15 months. And I will tell you, they've won to a certain degree. Nobody talks about ivermectin. Those who know, know. But those who've been convinced that it doesn't work, which is most of the advanced health economies around the world, they've gotten it removed from any consideration in any guideline. But I will tell you, there's a lot of frontline clinicians around the world who understood the data, has seen the efficacy firsthand, and are using these repurposed drugs to great effect, and they're saving lives. And so we're doing what we can to make sure that message gets heard.
I just want to say, you know, as coming from media and having left CBS, if you do not know this, the television that you are watching and the news anchors that you are listening to are owned by the pharmaceutical industry. 70% of our advertising is coming from the pharmaceutical industry. If you want to truly wake up this week, when you go back to your hotel room or you watch any news program or any television show you like to watch, start counting how many pharmaceutical ads you see. And then say, oh my God, that's who's paying for the information I'm getting. So if there's a problem with this vaccine, do you think they're going to say it? Do you think they're going to tell you? They can't, because their boss is pharma. I came from that. That's why I run my show as a nonprofit online. We now find ourselves, as we look at the potential, you know, 75% reduction in many of the studies that you brought forward of ivermectin, 75% reduction in deaths, serious illness. I mean, this would have been massively beneficial, because currently we're looking at, there's 29,273 reports of death on the VAERS capture system here in the United States of America. But beyond that, I mean, that could be multiple things, potentially vaccine injury, but we're over a million. We are, you know, well past a million deaths from COVID. And when you see that and say, we had a product that could have reduced 75% of those, you know, you worked for the Department of Defense. You have been involved in government. Did they deny life-saving drugs when it comes to hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and others? Did they deny those drugs, you know, in order to get an emergency use authorization for this vaccine?
So I'm absolutely convinced that they did. And here's why. I asked the FDA directly to comment to me about this hypothesis that they were blocking availability of early treatment and repurposed drugs in order to justify the emergency use authorization. They denied that is the case. I was lied to. You can find, if you dig into the documents, the emergency use authorizations, including this latest one that they just signed off for, you will find that there's a line in there that Peter Marks, head of the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research within the FDA, personally certifies that there is no alternative treatment for COVID-19. He has to make that personal certification in order for the emergency use authorization to be granted. It is clear, unequivocal fraud, in my opinion, and it is absolute documentation that they have, it's written into the law that they have to document, somebody has to sign off within the administrative state leadership that there is no other alternative, otherwise this whole house of cards falls down.
Am I to understand that the emergency use authorization that they keep having to call this an emergency, even though in every other aspect of this, we're now driving, we're flying, they've given up on it, but they're holding on to the emergency so they can keep avoiding safety tests, right? And so avoiding proper safety trials of booster shots and of vaccines for children.
So there's two key, and I tore this apart in Substack. You can find the Code of Federal Regulations, the specific citings if you want to go there. There's two key determinations that have to be made and have to be renewed. There's the emergency use authorization that we just talked about, and there's the declaration of medical emergency. I think that we can all see our hospitals are not full. We are not, the only people that are really suffering from the latest Omicron strain, frankly, are the highly vaccinated. The symptoms of Omicron are those of a cold, sore throat, runny nose, these kinds of things. There is no medical emergency. They're having to recertify that there's a medical emergency again and again and again and again, because if they don't, the entire thing collapses. The emergency use authorization for the antibodies, for the drugs, for the vaccines, their authority to implement mask restrictions, which, by the way, is clear overreach. The Constitution, this is super important for this community to understand. The way it works, as you all know, if it is not a power specifically vested to the federal government in the Constitution, it belongs to the states. And I can tell you, from as somebody that has specialized in public health and biodefense for decades, the feds have always walked on tiptoes into states, because states have the authority to regulate the practice of medicine. The CDC does not, the NIH does not, they have no authority. They have basically imposed all of these different strategies through the media, through all of this intimidation tactics, et cetera, and not the least of which is the exploitation of CMS and basically threatening the states, if you don't go along with what we tell you to do, we're gonna pull your money.
Right. Pierre, your license is now under review. As Dr. McCullough, and several other doctors, Dr. Merrick, that have all spoken out, have exemplary records on bringing people through COVID successfully using the drugs that that you have been very vocal about. When we look at this now, over a million, is it safe to say that, you know, by order of omission or taking away the use of products that could have worked, that our government is responsible for murdering at least 500,000 people?
There's absolutely no question. I mean, if you look at the science, had those repurposed drugs been deployed when we knew they were effective, many hundreds of thousands, probably at least 80 to 95% of those deaths could have been avoided. Hospitals would have been avoided. You wouldn't have the calamity of these hospitals overfilling in ICUs. I mean, there is a term that I heard the financial expert Ed Dowd use, and he says it's time to start calling this a democide, which is death by government. Mm. And I never thought I would say something so alarming, but when you look at the way our government has behaved, and I don't want to really call it our government, because like we mentioned, we talked about this earlier, those agencies are fully controlled by industry. We are the victims of really profiteering. They did everything, every manipulation they could in order to preserve profit, to sell the most vaccines, to get the most arms. When they started going into the childhood ages, I found that terrifying. We already knew that these were the most toxic and ineffective vaccines ever, yet they went after the 12 to 17 year olds, the 5 to 11 year olds, and then they got unanimous votes for toddlers, for whom this disease is barely anything, with a very toxic vaccine. We're seeing unrelenting death, all as an outgrowth of repeated policies. And what I've been saying since the beginning, any policy or decision you see coming out of the agencies, you need to do the following simple exercise. You need to read the policy and ask yourself, what would a pharmaceutical company want this policy to say? And then read it again. They are literally written by pharmaceutical and vaccination manufacturers. That everything is in order for them to gain as much of market share and to sell as much as their product. And they're doing this with a trail of bodies. And I have to tell you, this latest with the toddlers and with all of the evidence we have now, I mean, I don't know that the history books are gonna get this right, because I know who writes the history books. However, this is a humanitarian catastrophe that has resulted that will never be equaled. These vaccines are now showing up in life insurance data. Can I ask the audience a question?
Sure.
How many in this room are aware of the unprecedented rise in all-cause mortality in working-age American adults starting in 2021 at the onset of the vaccine campaign?
Nice.
And that's what I'm talking about. You can't hide it. How many of you are reading regularly newspaper articles about this new disease called SADS, sudden adult death syndrome? How many of you are aware that now they're starting to get shook up in the hospitals because the doctors, the nurses, and the ER physicians are starting to see strokes in 18-year-olds, brain bleeds that cause death in healthy 32-year-olds? There are young people dying across the country and world, and these articles are showing up in many countries. We are literally sitting in the middle of a humanitarian catastrophe, and that information, again, going back to censorship, has been suppressed. All you will see for a year, and this is where I have to forgive my colleagues in the healthcare system, is they are victims of unrelenting propaganda and censorship. They do believe that these vaccines are safe and effective. They do believe that the best thing for you is to get vaccinated. The trick that I will never forgive that they pulled off is convincing the entire health system that natural immunity is no longer a thing.
That's it. I mean, that's...
That you need a vaccine after... And that's the one that is unforgivable,
yep.
That you need to vaccinate against the disease that you just recovered from. And that is the most obscene and absurd trick that they pulled with that. It shows you how powerful that propaganda is.
Dr. Urso, to drill down on something that he just said, and I think for those people in the audience that, you know, went out and did their duty, got the vaccine, it's going to protect everyone around me, all of that, you know, you can understand how that sort of started. That seed was planted. It's a seed that's planted in our understanding of all vaccinations. But the CDC ended up changing the definition of a vaccine because of this failure. They started recognizing it doesn't stop infection. It doesn't stop transmission. And so, if I don't know if you know this, the CDC changed the definition from a product that basically creates immunity so you can't catch a disease. Now the definition of a vaccination by the CDC is simply a product that protects you from serious illness. So they've changed the definition. So no longer can anyone say that a vaccine creates herd immunity. But here's my point. When we think about people that we're listening to our doctors, and everywhere we go, everyone says, Del, are you telling me that my doctor is, you know, I shouldn't trust him as the authority? I mean, who am I? My doctor looks at all the studies, looks at all the trials, obviously wants to do what's best for me, you know, so are they, you know, are they evil people? How did this happen? How did so many doctors go forward, deny hydroxychloroquine, deny ivermectin, watch people die, put them on ventilators where, you know, 1 in 10 of them survived the ventilator, use remdesivir, a product that is clearly failing, causing kidney failure, and then ultimately a vaccine that doesn't stop infection, and then one booster, two boosters, four boosters. At a certain point, I've lost the ability to defend medicine. What the hell is going on with doctors in America and around the world?
The power of what you just said, the powerful forces, are what the doctors are feeling. I remember back in March 2020, one of the things I started talking about was prednisone. Pierre actually went to the Senate or Congress and talked about it and promoted it in a big way. And we got viciously attacked. It's very unnerving to get viciously attacked when you're talking about science. And so I think for physicians, they saw those things happening to those of us that were speaking out. They were very vicious attacks. I know Dr. Malone felt it, rewrote his history of his work on messenger RNA technology. You'll have a hard time finding it through a Google search that he had anything to do with it. But what I'm saying is the power of that. We even were told that if we wore a mask, we were wasting personal protective equipment. Only the people in the emergency room could wear them. So the power of that on the physicians very early on scared the bejesus out of most of the docs. And then they stopped looking. And let me add to that. When I was first in practice, most physicians were independently working. And now 75% of physicians work for another entity, either academic or a big Kaiser or something that is going to basically control their ability to pay their mortgage, to pay their kids' schooling and things like that. So physicians didn't do the data search. They didn't do it. They stopped doing it because they were scared and didn't want to look. So what happened was that the power of the orchestrated attack was felt. I can't tell you. I wanted to crawl under a rock. And then I talked to my wife. I prayed about it. And I basically came to the conclusion that I had to speak out because medical freedom is our right.
I mean, we're really talking about the death of the doctor-patient relationship. Do no harm, which means it doesn't matter the greater good. The person in front of me is who I'm treating, and I have to make sure that they survive. And it seems that our government, our regulatory agencies, as you said, with the hooks to pharma into them, said, throw all of that out. None of that matters now. It doesn't matter that there may be risks to this product. We don't even know what the risks are because we jumped out of the safety trials. Everybody has to take this risk for the greater good. And so all of medicine now no longer is the doctor. And by the way, you guys represent those doctors that did what we think they're doing. You read the studies. You looked at the trials. You said, this is a sham. These things aren't working. And now you have licenses under review. You've got the boards, the medical boards, now all writing dictates saying that any doctor that speaks out against the statements by the CDC is what is the protocols we're supposed to be used are going to find themselves under review. We are now, and think about this, folks. In America, we've been fighting socialized medicine for exactly this reason. We don't want to have some big conglomerate deciding our health. We want to have this interaction with our doctors. And now the CDC, the NIH, Tony Fauci, and all this, they're taking that away. And the funding from pharma into your medical boards, into all of these peer-reviewed journals, is taking away your ability to do your job, which is to take care of your patient. Am I missing something here?
The state of California is putting a law in place, trying really hard right now, that if any of us who happen to be practicing in California say anything contrary to the approved narrative, our licenses will be automatically pulled by state law.
I think to put that in perspective, I want to put that in perspective because this is why your licenses are up, because you challenged this vaccine. You said, I don't think it's effective. I don't know if you've seen this, but I have a video of Deborah Birx, who foisted this whole abomination upon this country. She was one of the players. Look at what she just said when she was pushed on this issue of, were you lying? Was this wishful thinking, dreaming? Can we play the video with Deborah Birx, please?
You're an expert. You were on the task force. You were part of this effort when you were in the previous administration. And you're saying in this administration that you can't rule out the fact that our government was lying to us when they told us the vaccinated could not get the virus.
I don't know about their discussions that they had in the task force. So I can't tell you that. I can tell you as a family member who had individuals that were susceptible, of course we got everybody vaccinated. But we still use layered protection during surges, because I knew potentially the vaccine immunity would wane like natural immunity waned. And there was evidence that every 4 months, reinfection was occurring in South Africa.
Wow. When the government told us that the vaccinated couldn't transmit it, was that a lie or was that a guess? Or is it the same answer?
I think it was hope that the vaccine would work in that way. And that's why I think scientists and public health leaders always have to be at the table, very clear what we know and what we don't know.
This is important for the country to know. So when I asked the question, when the government told us that the vaccinated couldn't get it, and I asked you if it was a guess or a lie, you said you don't know. You said you think it was hope. So what we do know is it wasn't the truth. So they were either guessing, lying, or hoping and communicating that information to the citizens of this country.
I think they were hoping, but you should know in those original phase 3 trials that were done in this country that we only measured for symptomatic disease. So we weren't proactively testing everybody in those trials to see if they got infected with mild or asymptomatic disease. And so people had to present within the clinical trials.
We never
had the data that it was going to protect against asymptomatic infection.
I'm just struck with the irony. We got government agencies guessing, hoping, or lying with the information they're presenting to the American people. And this is the same administration that wants to set up the disinformation governance board and wants to talk about misinformation. And they're the biggest purveyors of misinformation, false information, hopeful information, but not accurate and true information, which is, again, the frustration I think so many of the folks I get the privilege of representing have shared with me.
By the way, those are the types of politicians you should be thinking about voting in that are actually stepping up and asking the right questions. But I want to point out we have just a little bit of time here, how dangerous and precarious the moment we now find ourselves in. It is now known that everything that these guys were saying about vaccines was true. It is now known that they didn't stop infection, didn't stop transmission. We are seeing rises in all-cause mortality, a 40% rise in deaths in 18 to 64-year-olds across the insurance companies in the United States of America. Unexplained. There is a serious health problem now in this country, and the only thing that you can really point to is the vaccinations, yet the medical boards right now are writing laws based on, you know, pharmaceutical pressure that will say that it doesn't matter that Deborah Birx was lying to us, that they were in wishful thinking. Now, she wants to sound innocent about saying, well, it was wishful thinking, we wanted it to work. That would be fine if that was true and you were transparent with us as the community watching your news programs, but not only did you come out and say that this was going to stop infection, stop transmission, get us out of this pandemic, you were denying us drugs that could actually protect us and were getting us killed. And then on top of that, you started silencing every doctor that actually did have the science, even invented this damn thing and said, no, you're lying. And you were not allowing them to appear on CNN, them to speak their truth. Instead, you're trying to take away their licenses. You're going to hear a lot of important things here at Freedom Fest, but I will tell you, this is the issue of your time. You have lost control of your own body. I don't care about your gun rights, your banking rights, your land rights. If you don't control your own body, this is over. And if we don't stand up for the doctors that are telling the truth, what is the future for any of us?
You know, when you bring up the boards and we look at that piece and what you just talked about, I can't rank all of the terrifying and troubling things that's happened in society, but in a country like the United States that has a First Amendment, when I started seeing this push to go after the misinformationists, they wouldn't debate us, they wouldn't give us a public forum, and all of the complaints in my medical board, not one is from a patient, it's all from doctors who say that I should be delicensed because I spread misinformation. And then you saw the Department of Homeland Security come out with a new policy saying that those spreading misinformation of COVID have the capacity to incite violence around COVID. And then they said that that might meet the definition of a domestic terrorist. So one night I went to bed as a physician, and then I woke up with my government essentially accusing me of becoming a domestic terrorist. And then the boards now send me letters of documented statements and things that I've written and said in interviews, all backed up with data and evidence, and they're asking me to defend myself. And so there's this huge push, like Robert just mentioned about California. We're literally ignoring all of history, or we're ignoring the message in 1984. We're literally having ministries of truth, and they have to do it, because when they're not peddling in truth and they're peddling falsehoods and propaganda, they have to go after those speaking truth. And yeah. So I thought I was just doing the right thing, trying to become expert. I wanted to figure out this disease. This is how it started. I was like, we got to figure this thing out and figure out how to treat it. And everything I've discovered and tried to disseminate has not been welcomed by those in power, and we have to stand up against that.
Well, we just have a couple minutes left, and there's so much to talk about on this topic. And by the way, these guys have videos all over the internet, including the work you're all doing together through the Global COVID Summit. Look that up. Look at that website. So much important information. But for just a couple minutes here, what is the way forward? What is the way out? We have a leaky vaccine. It's not stopping infection, not stopping transmission. We're moving into the fifth booster. It looks like that is really destroying the immune systems of lots of people. We still have products like ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, out there, if they could be utilized. If your head of health and human services tomorrow, Dr. Robert Malone, and maybe you guys, yeah, CDC and NIH, how should we move forward right now with all the knowledge we now have in this nation and around the world? How do we get out of this?
So first off, I want to recommend to you the book of my friend Matthias Desmet, The Psychological Basis of Authoritarianism, of Totalitarianism. And you can find a great video on the Highwire website with a fantastic interview there. Second, these vaccines are driving something called immune imprinting. This is creating a form of immune bias. It is the reason why the flu vaccines don't work very well, the same exact mechanism. And They are proposing to give all of us, they've already bought $3.2 billion worth of a trivalent vaccine that has not been manufactured, will not be clinically tested, and will be, for some reason, deployed right before the election, okay? And it couldn't have been designed better to damage your ability to resist further Omicron infection, okay? The vaccination must stop. Do not vaccinate your children. These vaccines need to be withdrawn. They are not effective and they are not safe. This is unequivocal. The vaccines are not effective. They're not safe. Continued administration only makes the situation worse. So what are you gonna do for, because the data from all over the world, and Pierre just pulled up another article moments ago, the data from all over the world are showing that the ones that are getting into the hospital almost exclusively now, well over 90%, the ones going to the hospital and dying with Omicron are the highly vaccinated. Yep. Okay, what are we gonna do for them? They're already damaged. Number one, the first rule of holes. When you're in one, stop digging. Okay, someone needs to teach this to Tony Fauci. Number two, we have multiple early treatments. They save lives. We have to make them widely available. We have to make it clear to our population who the government has a responsibility to protect us, why we're paying them.
Yep.
Okay? We're paying them to protect us, not to generate pharmaceutical industry profits. Okay? These guys and their peers, and to some extent our group, has also demonstrated multiple different early treatment options. They keep you out of the hospital. They keep you alive. The mortality rate from early treatment is negligible. And by the way, you don't see this kind of recidivism, this reinfection that you see with Pavloxid, strangely enough. And that is how we have to get out of this, is we have to make these drugs, these treatments, available to all of you and your children and your older relatives.
What is this audience, Pierre, Richard, what can they do to help that
So I want to answer your question, though. I'll answer both questions. If I were ever put in charge of the response to this, first thing I would have done, national public service campaign, telling all the doctors to check the vitamin D levels of all their patients and put them on a replenishment protocol, getting those levels above 50. If you had just done that simple thing, the government knows, and they've known for decades, that in some estimates, 90% of our population is vitamin D deficient. And that's deficient even according to their very low levels of vitamin D. Had we done a national vitamin D replenishment campaign, that would have changed the face of this. And then I'll just piggyback on Robert. Our protocols work. We have dozens of compounds. Many of them are over the counter. Doing povidone iodine nasal drops and mouthwashes will drastically reduce your need for hospitalization. There are simple solutions, especially when used in combination. We have just one of the protocols. Many of them work, but you can go to flccc.net, and that's how to give you agency in order to protect your health and protect your life and those of your loved ones.
Dr. Urso, some final thoughts.
These are great points, and I want to say one of the things. We're here at Freedom Fest. We need to fight for our medical freedom first, all right? First. These vaccines, all right, they go everywhere, all right? They produce toxin for who knows how long. They uptick viruses, dormant viruses in your body. We're now seeing almost the doubling of Bell's palsy, the doubling of the Epstein-Barr, you're seeing these things happen. Shingles. The data's out. We're also seeing an increase in fertility issues. We saw a 30% decrease in the Israeli study of men in their sperm. It quote unquote recovers. How about five shots later? Okay? So you're starting to see that in Germany and other places. You're starting to see the effects of this vaccine. 92% of the deaths in England were in the triple vaccinated. Don't get more shots. Do not do it. We're seeing an uptick in cancers. We're seeing that it actually destroys something that's very important, our DNA repair mechanisms, called P53, the guardian of the genome. These are things that are very hard to fix. If you keep putting this toxic product in your body, it's only going to get worse. But they're going to come at us with every single platform, messenger RNA. They're going to come with the lipid nanoparticles. They're going to go all over your body, and they're going to keep coming over and over and over. And you need to stand up and fight, especially for our kids. And here's the thing. In England, the data is there's at least a 52 times higher incidence of death in the children from 10 to 14 in the vaccinated. We need to stop the vaccine program.
I want to thank my guests. I want to thank Freedom Fest. If you want more information on this, go to flcc.com. Check out Robert Malone's Substack. He's writing every single day. It's brilliant. Global COVID Summit. These guys are all a part of that. GlobalCOVIDSummit.com. And if you want to avoid being lied to ever again, make sure you're watching thehighwire.com, where we tell the truth and nothing but the truth. Thank you very much.